Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got David Weinberger, Nina Paley, and me. We're going to talk about restaurants that know you like scones and Facebook drones. See how I didn't rhyme those? We've got lots more to you next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 264, recorded June 20th, 2014. All in, all out, or all wrong. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like cherry vanilla granola. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I am so excited to have two of my favorite people in the world and certainly favorite people online joining us today. Now, don't get too sad. Evan Brown could not join us today. He's taking the week off, but we will see him next week. But we're going to have some consolation for you because our guests are just phenomenal. First of all, we have David Weinberger joining us of hyperorg.com, co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto, fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard, and so many other things, author of many things since the Clue Train Manifesto as well, one of my favorite books ever, Small Pieces Loosely Joined, just an amazing speaker and humorous person and wonderful human being. Hello, David. It's great to have you on.
Hi. I feel like I have already disappointed you given that introduction. Thank you very much.
It's impossible to disappoint. Also impossible to disappoint is Nina Paley, very active on copyright reform, creative person herself with animation and quilts and various other wonderful endeavors, and repeat guest to the show. So Nina, we're so glad that you could join us once again.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a challenge to disappoint
yes.
you.
Oh, okay, good. Now we're all just going to shut
you
up.
It can't be done. It can.
It can. We're just now. That's it. That's the show. We'll wrap now, and you can all go. I mentioned the Clue Train Manifesto for folks who may not have encountered it before, and I realized, David, there are people that you have not been able to influence with this book simply by virtue of time. It came out in 2000, and you guys had the 10th anniversary of it. Obviously, that would have been in 2010, although it feels like it just happened. So for those who have not read it, I can't tell you how current this book still is and prescient, and basically, foresees all of the social interactions that the web has enabled since its publication, and still gives very, very good advice to businesses and people who want to interact commercially in doing it in a genuine voice and avoiding the missteps that happen when you act like a corporation instead of a person. So it's a really, really valuable read for just about anybody. And I think, one of those books that's just timeless. And David, I have to show you, because I think I may be the only living human who has a copy of the book signed by all three authors, and that I still have it and haven't put it on eBay yet. But we'll see how today goes. How about that?
Excellent. We can drive the price up to well over $2 at this point. So
there we go. Yes, exactly. Since we're talking about the social web, let's start there kick off this discussion. All All right. So one of the topics of the Clue Train manifesto is how businesses communicate with customers. And I think it's kind of interesting to consider, what are we now, 14 down the road, years down the road since its publication. There's recently been a study and a write-up in The Atlantic about online advertising, concluding that it probably just doesn't work at all, which is, I think, something that you guys had in mind when you wrote the book, David. And the study I'm referring to is a new controlled study on search ads from eBay. And it goes through, the Atlantic article is quite good explaining what sort of ads it's talking about. It's how you would get an ad for Nike if you're searching for Nike, a sponsored ad from Nike, for example. And then you would, just taking you to Nike.com. And then below that, you would get Nike Inc. And the point of this study and the failure that eBay found was that it's basically impossible to tell whether someone is going to a site because they have seen an ad or because they already intended to go there in the first place. It's just getting harder and harder to know what is influencing and how. And so the upshot is that, you know, you just can't reliably say, oh, they saw this ad, and so ergo, they bought the product. The reason I bring this up, David, is because of the Clue Train backdrop and because of considerations that go into laws around online advertising, what you can and cannot do and what has to be disclosed if you are speaking as a person who's pushing a product. So I'm wondering what you make of this. And, you know, is it just kind of duh? You know, we've known all along online ads don't work. And thanks for telling us again.
So in your really lovely introduction, Denise, you said that Clue Train foresaw the rise of the social web. And that gives us too much credit. Clue Train was an attempt in 1999 when we were writing it to say things that we thought people on the web already knew, but the media in general and the business in general did not know, namely that the web is social. The web was social from the very beginning. That's what drove it forward. It looked like a publishing medium to the media because that's their frame for these things, and it looked like a catalog shopping opportunity and advertising opportunity to businesses because that's their frame. But the reason so many people rushed onto the web and were so excited about it was because from the very first, it was profoundly a social environment in which we got to speak with one another about the things that we care about. And advertising almost always has been about what other people want us to see against our will. It's what's interesting to them, namely getting us to buy their crap. And so therefore, ads from the very beginning have always seemed like an intrusion from another world. I mean, the web is our world. We built it together socially. It's about things that matter to us. And ads have always been a bit foreign in that. The difference between online and offline ads is that in offline advertising, you had no idea what the connection was between the ad and the behavior of the market. You could only guess at best that an ad was effective or not. On the web, we get closer because you can actually, you know, see the clicks, but you can't, you're right. It's, and The Atlantic is right. You can't see the intention behind the click or what actually got the person's interest, because that still remains a human thing and not expressible by a simple, you know, click of a mouse. Advertisers continue to want to believe that ads work. I think to a large extent, in many ways they do, especially branding ads do work. Trying to establish the causality is extremely difficult. And this, the last thing to say is that we now have, thanks to the web, the ability to fight back against the attempts to control our desires and motivations by marketers and advertisers. So when an ad makes a claim, and I think all of us do this all the time, an ad makes a claim in something that we're interested in, we'll go online and check it out according to people who've actually used it, other customers, other people. And so ads no longer have the sort of blind one-way thrust that they used to, because we can countervail that with human voices.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical part of the advertising universe today. And it's why I think the FTC is so concerned about sponsored statements online. Of course, the FTC has guidelines and fines in place, although I'm unaware of someone having been hit with one of these fines. It's always interesting to watch, because having the proper disclosures made is still sort of a work in progress, and people aren't quite sure how to do them, even though the FTC has told people specifically, you know, they've gotten so specific, this is so unlike a government agency, as to say, you know, if you're on Twitter and you're making a sponsored statement about a product, just put in hashtag ad. That's all you have to do. It's three characters out of your 140, and then people will know. Well, even with that simple bit of instruction, it doesn't look like people have gotten the message yet. And there was a particularly funny instance written up by Ginny Martin this week at Marketingland that involved Mike Arrington being pitched by some marketer working for Microsoft, and specifically working with the Rethink IE blogger network, bloggers that were using the hashtag IE bloggers, sharing sponsored posts about Internet Explorer. And at one point or another, the bloggers in this network being paid for their chatty and positive things about Internet Explorer were putting hashtag ad. Then it seems like there must have been a memo, because then they weren't. Then they approached Mike Arrington and said, hey, would you like to be in our network? You know, talk about needing to get on the clue train. Somebody missed it there, because that's how the story became public, that IE had a bloggers network that was doing sponsored posts and not doing it in the FTC approved way. And so, you know, what happened then was the hijacking of the IE bloggers hashtag, and much hilarity and lampooning of the entire process. And of course, Microsoft had to fire the agency. So you can see how, you know, trustworthy statements from people reviewing products are really at the forefront of what needs to be going on in online advertising, not just from the regulatory standpoint, but from the human standpoint. That's how we all decide whether or not something is trustworthy. Do you have any thoughts on this, Nina?
Well, my cat just joined me.
And of course, when a cat makes a statement online, that's the most trustworthy thing of all.
Yeah, well, the internet is made of cats.
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking, first of all, it's increasingly ambiguous what is an ad and what is not. I wasn't even aware of all these laws governing advertising online. Because when I think about advertising, I think about the whole issue of what's commercial and what's not commercial, and nobody's really figured that out. So I am a little bit curious as to how they even define an ad. How is that defined?
It's as far as the FTC is concerned, whenever you're making a positive statement about again, I'm paraphrasing, but it's positive statements about products or services where you're getting something in return for making those statements. But I see what you're saying as far as how it can get quite, you know, the line between ad and review is quite murky.
I wonder,
it's the quid pro quo, I think, that is the touchstone there.
I wonder for myself, because, you know, let's say I have a movie or something that I want people to know about. you know, or let's say I have, you know, merchandise on my online store that I want people to know about. If I tell people about that, is that an ad or is it not an ad? Because nobody's paying me to talk about this stuff. And then
if you had a network of folks who you were giving some kind of quid pro quo to promote your movie or product in your online store, that would be when you'd get into trouble. Okay. It's when it's not transparent that, hey, this is my thing and you should buy it or watch it.
Okay.
So the whole IE blogger thing was sort of funny and sort of one of those, again, you just slap your head and go, really? This kind of thing still happens? And how have people managed to be so clueless?
Well, except that it happens all the time. We actually don't know how often it happens successfully. So at Reddit, I think last week, there was a really interesting and exciting thread about a wacky idea that was, you know, was interesting, which was to pave roads with solar power generators. And there's a lot of discussion about whether it was possible or not, because, you know, and some very fervent supporters of it. And it was only a few days later that somebody tracked back through the fervent supporters, looked at their histories and discovered, yeah, these people obviously pretty clearly were shills, were paid. So we sometimes have the mechanism to discover the shills, but we don't always, and we don't know how often we don't. And so while Clutrain says, yes, you know, corporations don't know how to speak like humans and shouldn't try or should learn how to get humans involved in the discussion, which I still sort of think is kind of right. The other part of it is that corporations have gotten very good at sounding like humans or hiring humans in ways that corrupt the system, that make the overall network less trustworthy and less good. I think there's a clear moral dimension here, which is your behavior or the behavior of your corporation making the place better or worse? And hiring shills and astroturfing clearly makes it worse.
Yeah, and astroturfing isn't restricted to the internet. I mean, that's something they've done for decades.
Much easier to do on the internet, though. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Right? But you don't have to hire college-age people to go into a bar and good-looking guys to go into a bar and drink Budweiser. You know, you can do it a lot more cost-effectively now. So, yay. And people who want to corrupt the system, marketers who are engaged in the systematic corruption of the system should go to hell. You know, what it comes down to for me.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing. So I never get offers from anybody to pay me to shill something. But being a social person online, I get endless, if I'm supposed to seem like a nice person, I'm supposed to promote the Kickstarters of everybody that I'm acquainted with. And that's happening also. This is not really related to the laws about advertising, but every day there's this temptation to promote something, not because you actually believe in it, but because there's, I don't know, a little bit of
social pressure.
Social extortion almost. And this is very common. And, you know, everybody has to make a decision. Like, am I going to risk this person not liking me or many people not liking me? There is this expectation, you know, support me, right? Like if I don't promote something for somebody, then I'm not supportive and I'm not a good friend. Everybody has to decide that. But I do feel like if I just start promoting everything just because it's the project of somebody that I'm somehow connected with, that also degrades the whole system. And I just don't want to do it. So I end up saying no to most things.
You're a good example, and I think that does help the credibility of the things that you do promote. You know, I think that's more of a personal decision that people have to make than a business or a legal one, although it certainly could have business and legal repercussions as well. But the value of the endorsements you do make, I think, is something that people need to pay attention to. Another thing to pay attention to is, you know, we're all fairly visible people online. And, you know, certainly we can be located and things can be discovered about us because we all have sort of digital breadcrumbs we've left over the years. So I wanted to pick both of your brains on some overarching privacy considerations. Mm. There we go. All right. So this week there was an interesting article and one of several, probably dozens that have come out in the wake of the revelations of NSA surveillance. This particular one was in Wired and some very good practical advice, mostly on using Tor. The name of the article is How to Anonymize Everything You Do Online. And goes through step by step to through various ways you can use Tor on various devices and its efficacy on all of those devices, with the upshot that mobile browsing is still a work in progress from the privacy standpoint. You know, this is, as I mentioned, this is by no means an isolated bit of this kind of advice. You know, we've highlighted lots of them before on the show. It seems to be something that people are very interested in, that whatever digital breadcrumbs they're leaving are their own business, and they're going to decide, or they'd like to be able to decide, whether anybody has access to them. I think this particular take is showing you, hey, you know, if you don't want to participate in the system of being targeted with ads or being otherwise monitored online, this is how you can attempt to opt out. But the pushback then, and Robert Scoble on his Facebook page voiced it pretty well, is, but then you're leaving yourself out of all of the benefits that come when you are monitored and tracked and people are trying to customize your experience based on things that can be discovered about you online. And Robert's been on the show before and people are familiar with him. He lives very publicly and doesn't hide much of anything about his doings, likes, dislikes, travels. If you know, his cell phone number is public online, and you know, he has described himself as all in. You know, take as much of my information as you want, because I'm benefiting from that. And he posits that other people are either all out, like perhaps if you're following the advice in the Wired article, or somewhere in between. And I'm guessing that we're all somewhere in between. And I bring this up this week because David has teed up at the discussion quite wonderfully with a post on his blog that is one of the funniest things I've read in a long time, in reaction to news that there was a restaurant. Was it in New York, David?
I have no recollection what you're referring to, so please continue.
Oh, I will.
Oh, I do. Yeah, I got it. Yep.
Yes,
yeah.
There was a restaurant that was Googling customers and attempt their wonderful Ars Technica write-up of the fact that there was an employee at the restaurant whose job it was. I guess the only way this would work, I suppose, is if the restaurant... I guess it would work better if you had an online reservation service that was, you know, saying, okay, here's John Smith lives in this place, and here's some rudimentary information that he's given us through the online booking service. I suppose it could work if you simply had the person's name, although, you know, the common name problem would wind up with some really funny mistakes, I suppose, if you're trying to Google a customer with a name like John Smith. You're not going to find out much useful information. But David wrote up what I consider like a one-act play of a hypothetical restaurant that was finding out information about the customer and trying to customize the experience of the customer in such a way that it just completely creeps you out. So I encourage people to go read it. It's at hyperarg.com, David's blog. It's called Reservations. And I'm so glad I have the two of you on the show because, Nina, this thing screams out to have one of your animations made of it. It needs to be scripted and acted out.
Well, I did that one for the EFF a couple years ago about how all of your, it's called, I think they ended up calling it Happy Birthday EFF, but that's not really what it was about. But it's weird because the framing of this seems wrong. The framing seems off. It's not a matter of, you know, oh, are all these, you know, company, are these services monitoring me? You know, if I think that's a bad thing, I'll opt out. And, you know, but the benefit I'm getting so many benefits from being monitored that no, I'll opt in. And that's not what the issue is. The issue is that these services are monitoring everything. And if you opt out, it's not that you don't get the benefit of being monitored. It's that you don't get the services and the, you know, access to the online world that many people want and need. I mean, I would like to note that we are doing this connection over Skype.
Right.
Skype is not really known for respecting our privacy. And I could opt out from this. I could be like, no, you know, we have to use something that's not Skype. And, you know, that means if I take that stance, that means that I'm going to be not able to do this or a number of other things. And the problem isn't that, oh, I won't enjoy the benefits of being monitored. The problem is, you know, I won't be able to communicate with, you know, people, most of whom it's just too much trouble to try to stay. I mean, not even too much trouble. It's, I mean, for me, for a normal person, it's practically, I think it is impossible to do all the kind of opting out that I keep reading articles about. It's possible. I mean, even the thing with credit cards, like I got that email from Target, you know, Target was compromised and my credit card's compromised everywhere, right? There's one hacking thing after another. And it's like, okay, cancel your credit card now, call the credit card company. And if I did that, I would be canceling my credit card every week. And, you know, I just go like, I can't live this way.
Right. Or really if you're not doing it, they are. I mean, I'm constantly getting credit cards replaced just without my having to do anything, but you get a new one in the mail saying, oops, we've had some sort of snafu and we needed to reissue your credit card.
But a lot of times that's not happening. I mean, I guess the thing is, I really respect, privacy advocacy is very, very important, but to leave the onus on everybody on the internet rather than these, you know, large systems that are surveilling us all the time, I think that's not fair and not right. I think that these companies need to be responsible, and given that we have, you know, and our government also, but that's clearly asking too much. So I don't really know what to do.
So, well, me neither. But I find privacy issues really, really confusing, and not because of the law, which I, you know, I am not a lawyer. I don't even pretend to understand. But privacy, in the sense that we're using it, for a lot of the sense in which we're using it, is a matter of norms, always has been a matter of norms. So, and they're very they have been very carefully calibrated social norms that govern, for example, how closely you can listen and be observed listening to somebody who's a couple who's walking ahead of you on the street. You know, they're in public, so it's okay to hear what they're saying. But you can't follow them because you found the topic interesting, and you cannot acknowledge that you heard them. You can't go up to them and say and offer your opinion. It's just not done. It's the norm, and the same thing for all sorts of, you know, elevator behavior around privacy is also all of these are highly governed by very particular norms of privacy in public. And now we have this new type of public where there initially weren't. It started without norms or strong norms. Norms are developing. These are it's an intersection of global cultures. The norms are different across these cultures. And so it's two things. A, it's really, really confusing. It's extremely easy to go wrong. And this B, did I say one or two? One. Okay, I think it's B. like to keep these things straight. these norms are changing, and so the sort of moral argument that you have, that one has, where you compare what Amazon does with your data to what, say, a real world store like Target would do with it, and what's acceptable, they don't apply. It's a very, very different situation. I'm sort of not terribly exercised by the old norms of privacy online. I tend a little bit more towards Scopel, although I think obviously we all are concerned when there are clear abuses of it. It's just that it's necessarily a really gray area, because norms take a long time to emerge, and when they're changing, it's very difficult even to have a reasonable conversation about what's right, because we don't know. It's a matter of norms.
Right. So I think if Robert Scoble walked into your hypothetical restaurant in your post, David, he would welcome the maitre d' with open arms and shake his hand and say, you know, right on. Good for you having the initiative to find out when my birthday was and anniversary and what sort of food I might like. Although your post. Yeah. Go
when
ahead.
The waiter posts online Scoble's porn preferences and pictures of him showering, I know Robert a little bit. I don't know what his reaction would be, but it's conceivable that he would not be as sanguine. That he's actually drawing a second set of, assuming a second set of norms, which I think is totally reasonable. But it's also, I think, important to recognize that the second set of norms is just another set of norms, and I think we are in fact moving towards the ones that Robert is enunciating. And those are not norms of complete privacy. It's just a different set of what we are allowed to hear and to notice to acknowledge that we've heard in public.
Robert's not a good example because he posts his own pictures of himself in the shower. So somebody else might be more taken aback by that.
I clearly need to be following him more closely.
Go ahead, Nina.
I figure anything that I put on the internet, that I myself put on the internet, is fair game for anybody. I'm not interested in that kind of privacy. What gets me concerned is the surveillance of people that I know and interactions that I'm having with other people. And I don't know if this is just hearsay or what, but a friend of mine was telling me that Facebook, if you have the Facebook mobile app, it will examine your phone and, you know, triangulate data on people in your phone contacts that may not even have Facebook accounts. That I find, I mean, I continue to use Facebook, but it's like, I just feel like there's all kinds. I don't think surveillance is like, oh, they're going to use a picture of mine that I put online. I don't care if I put my stuff online, I really don't care. But there's more than just me. There's all the connections that I have to other people.
Okay, so let's use a couple of Facebook examples, get your feedback or reaction to them. News this week that Facebook has filed a trademark application in class 12, which is for physical goods and not services. And it is prospective. So it's not something that it's doing now, but expects to be doing in the future. It identifies the goods to be sold as drones. Let me get the exact terminology that they use, but the upshot is, let's see, unmanned aerial vehicles. So Facebook, like Amazon, has drones in its future, so it thinks. And the speculation is that it plans to sell drone products branded with its name. Do you have any sort of privacy reaction to having Facebook having unmanned aerial vehicles? At least they're marked, you know, at least they're broadcasting that they would, again, that's just, this is all just speculation. All we have to go from is the application. They seem to be wanting to associate the Facebook trademark with drones.
Amazon is weaponizing theirs, so this is a little better than that anyway.
Exactly.
I don't know what to think. It's just, the world is moving too fast for me to even think. It's like, it's just happening. I'm just like, what?
Well, it's perfect marriage. People are so concerned about the privacy ramification of commercial drones. Anyway, it just makes perfect sense to pair Facebook up with one. Then there is, it's soon to be released. In fact, I'm not even sure if it's available today or not. It was expected to be out this week. Facebook's Snapchat competitor, let me see, it's called Slingshot, or will be called Slingshot. And it's also engaging in ephemeral sending of pictures and videos back and forth. In fact, if I've read the coverage correctly, it's only going to be photo and video based, although it will be possible, and I'm not sure how easily it will be possible, to superimpose some text over your image or video. But the two kickers are, it will be ephemeral. Like Snapchat, it will go away when the user tells it to go away. Let's see. You can't view an incoming message, though, until you respond with a photo or video of your own. There can't be any passive users. So again, you know, we're talking about quid pro quos in advertising. This is quid pro quos in communication. In order to see what someone has sent you, you have to respond back. Until you do that, you get a pixelated image. So what do you think of Facebook getting into the ephemeral communications arena and also sort of hijacking you into participating once you've, if you want to see what someone has sent you, David?
Oh, well, so I find it hard to complain both that Facebook is holding on too much data and it's moving into ephemeral communication. I hadn't heard about the you must respond with a photo thing for Sling Chat or whatever the hell it is. which is, on the one hand, this is back to the old original, because I'm an old man. I remember the original notion of viral marketing, which was exactly the sort of marketing that requires the recipient to respond in a way that the chain continues, just like an actual virus, you know, sort of sneeze to sneeze. And this is really brilliant viral marketing. I'm so out of their demographic, I'm not entitled to an opinion on it, and I actually don't have one. Whatever people get used to is what they will find normal and will do. So I will just throw in this, that 15 years ago, did I mention I'm old? 15 years ago, if you told people there would be surveillance cameras throughout entire cities, hundreds of thousands of surveillance cameras in London or in your local town, it would have been pitchfork time. And it's happened, and it doesn't seem to have changed much behavior, and nobody cares. It's not an issue. It's not a political issue. It just happened. We're all constantly having our photos taken by these surveillance cameras, and basically nobody except a handful of people care about it. I should say I don't care about it, but this sort of change happens. Norms are set by usage and getting used to things, and we get used to a lot. So
I know people that care about this. It bothers,
well, of course,
a lot
you
of people.
Do. You're with
not
EFF.
That young.
You're with EFF, you know. But it is not a political issue. Right? Surveillance cameras, generally, there are in some towns it has been, but it's not on the political agenda. It's not that important, apparently.
Well, I guess it's not a mainstream political issue. I guess my thing is, privacy and security issues are just sort of like this sort of dark cloud that I don't really know details about. And I personally don't really do anything, to protect myself or anything like that. It's like a sort of generalized sense of, wow, they're just getting, you know, they meaning not, there's, what is it? It's not symmetrical. It's not like this data is accessible to everybody. There are, whether it's the corporation that's collecting this or whether it's the government, there's this real imbalance of who has the data and who can access it and who doesn't. I would feel better about all of this if the data were accessible to everybody, but it's not. And I just find it's a background issue for me, but it's like, wow, large, powerful organizations and corporations have a lot more information than I and my peers will ever have. It gives me a real sense of uneasiness and like there's something not quite right about this, but I haven't made that a forefront issue.
Me too. So I'm not saying, so I want to be clear because I'm probably sounds like I'm, let me be clear. Personally am not bothered by the collection of data. I'm not particularly exercised about it. The American public and the world public has not reacted in a way that would say it's a mainstream issue. It's top, you know, there's nobody who's campaigning on NSA, control the NSA as a big issue, even though perhaps they should be. And I share your discomfort, your more than discomfort, in fact, about it. I would very much like to see whatever sorts of genuine safeguards there can be against the blatant misuse of this information to round up people that a government doesn't like. And we haven't quite seen that happen yet, but I would like to make sure that when some despicable administration gets elected, that their hands are tied. I'm not a lawyer, don't know how to do that, but I think it's really important that we have these safeguards in place, and we don't at this point.
So, David and Nina, we put some phrases in our show from time to time for people who are listening to the show for continuing legal education or other professional credit, and we have some listeners who do that. So I think we'll make our first phrase for this episode of This Week in Law, Sling Chat. And if you write that one down, and there will be another one to be named later on in the show, then you'll have an easier time demonstrating to whatever oversight board you are accountable to that you actually listened through the show and didn't just put it down on a form and say, yes, I listened to episode 264 of This Week in Law. We can actually verify that for you by burying these little phrases in the show. If you need more information about watching the show for professional credit, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find the This Week in Law page there, and we've got lots of information there for you on how that works. Let's see. Let's talk about education. David, I know that you're doing a lot of work with the library at Harvard. You just gave the commencement address at Simmons College, which if folks... do you know if there's a video of that, David? I've read your Medium post with the text.
I believe... there were video cameras. You know, the school had video cameras out, so I assume that there is. But, you know, if you're in the vague possibility that you're interested in it, it reads faster than it sees.
So. Well, David's full address, in addition to everything else we've been discussing today, you can get to quickly if you go to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/264. All our discussion points for the show are there. And one of the points that you made in your address, David, is just the overwhelming amount of information that is out there. And this flows very well from what we were just discussing, you know, whether it's information about you that you have access to or not, or just information about the world and the entire body of knowledge. It seems to me that we're at a real turning point in the world of education. And David, since you've done so much study and writing on that, I thought we'd just get your take.
Well, okay. So the point I was trying to make in that talk, that portion of that talk, was that if you Google for cute kittens, you'll get 27 million photos of, you know, images of cute kittens. And there's, you know, apple pie recipes, you get hundreds of thousands or millions of them and the like. But we don't feel overwhelmed by those. We don't talk about apple pie overload or cute kitten overload. But we do talk about information overload, and so the question is why. And I think that the answer is that is simple, which is we don't feel any responsibility to see all 27 cat photos or to try all those recipes. But for some reason, and there's actually a good historical reason, we feel that we have a responsibility to master information. The historical reason why is that our old media. You know, paper and TV and the like were so limited in what they could give us that they could maintain the illusion that they were that mastery was possible. So when I was a lad, you had a civic responsibility to read a newspaper every day. If you were a good citizen, if you did that, because that what that gave you the world in 20 minutes in, you know, this one set of papers. And that seemed reasonable. But now we can see that that was a lie. That was an illusion. There's no possibility of mastering everything that's going on in the world, mastering the day's current events or the day's news, because we can see just how much there is. It's the internet. We can see that there is far more. We could spend all day trying to keep up with world news and still fail at it. And so I think that in this equation, what happens is that we feel overloaded because we feel a sense of obligation as if mastery were possible. And I think what's happening is we're giving up on the notion of mastery, that we now are able to recognize that the world is far, far bigger and far more interesting than we ever thought it was. So much so that the idea of mastering even relatively small domains of it is just not, it's just not plausible. We're giving up on that illusion, which I think is a very healthy thing.
What do you think it says about higher education? If we're giving up on the notion of mastery, where does something like Harvard University fit into that equation?
Well, so the last thing I want to do is talk for Harvard University. But right. So I'm going to leave that, that to the side.
Pick a college of your choice.
Well, so I'll address it a little bit more generally. It's a huge, huge issue for education. So it's easy within some domains. I mean, if you're a medical doctor, there actually is a body of material that the discipline correctly insists that you master. You can't say, well, I didn't get around to tongue depressors or cancer symptoms. There is a body of material. And the same way in each discipline. Each discipline, if you're a chemist, you really do have to know the periodic table of elements. You can't say, wait, which one is hydrogen and look it up in Google real fast. That's just not acceptable. To be a chemist means to master this discipline. And that is not changing all that much. It is some, but not, because the disciplines are getting messier, which is a good thing. And so universities, colleges still have a job to do in helping us to master subdomains according to the rules of that subdomain. But this is occurring within a context in which even within, you know, one of these domains, one of these disciplines, there is so many links in and out, so many discussions to have, and such a complete and persistent awareness of controversy and contradiction and the fact that facts, in fact, don't settle the way that they used to, that it is, I think, changing the overall idea of what it means to be educated and the domain-specific ideas about what it means to be a master or a good citizen of that domain.
What do you think about things like Udacity and this notion written up in the New York Times of a nano degree, where perhaps you don't have a traditional demonstration of mastery through a college diploma, but you have taken a course, you haven't had to go through the entire liberal arts education, but you have mastered a particular area through something like Udacity, and you're then employable.
So we're so at the beginning of figuring out how to do online education, especially at massive scale. And in many instances, these MOOCs, these, you know, massively online open courseware, are repeating the early days of education, where you have somebody on stage, and frequently in these early stages, the best lecturers that the college has. So these are great courses, but they are very much initially, they've been very much one way. Not all of them, but many of them are. It's a sort of broadcast lecture model. That we were right at the beginning of figuring how to do this, what the right balance is, and how to manage at scale. I don't think we're there yet. There's some promising experiments. The badging or nano degrees seem to me to be pretty much inevitable. If you are, say, in a developing world, a developing country, or a part of the world where you simply don't have access to the great educational opportunities that so many of us have been privileged to have, then getting a badge saying, yeah, you took these three computer science courses at MIT, that, why wouldn't that count for something? I mean, why wouldn't somebody look at that and say, oh, yeah, that, okay, that counts, that matters. So it seems to me a little bit inevitable that that'll work?
Yeah, I hope so. I think we're at a real crossroads in how people will obtain their mastery, and that the whole higher education system is operating in a way that if it continues on in the way that it's done over the last several decades, I think they're going to find themselves disrupted by things like Udacity and Udacity leverages the higher education system, but you know what I'm getting at, the whole notion that we're going to have selective admissions and charge a lot of money to get you here physically on our campus. And, you know, that's how we continue on with our business model.
One of the most amazing things to me that's going on is, in addition to this MOOC stuff, which I think is incredibly rich and provocative and interesting, is the assumption now, the norm, if you will, that education should be something done in public so the public can learn from it. So a place like Stack Overflow, if you're a software developer, you're probably spending some time at Stack Overflow, where people ask questions and get responses and get conversations around the responses about how to do something with a particular, how to write a particular piece of software code. The assumption is that if I have a question, somebody else may have the same question, and we might as well get it answered once, answered well, and make it available to everyone. And this is so enriching for the entire ecosystem. This is the opposite of the corrupting influence of bad advertisers and shills. On the other side of it, there's this idea of public learning that is just amazing and we take for granted and is a wonderful progress.
Nina, do you feel like we're living in a better educated world based on the knowledge that people have access to on their desktops?
There's a difference between education and, you know, knowledge and learning. When I think about education, when you talk about educational institutions, they seem to have a monopoly on learning and knowledge, but they really don't. And it is a strange thing for me to be in this world where people seem to, well, there's just so much emphasis placed on these institutions. And here I am at the University of Illinois campus. This is where I grew up. My dad was a math professor. I myself am a proud college dropout, and I'm self-taught. Being self-taught, I learned things that simply were not available in college. I'm sure they're available now. I ended up teaching some of these things when I was in New York at Parsons. But the internet certainly, is amazing. Like, you need to go to one of these institutions to get a mark or a degree. But to get actual information and to actually learn things, there is so much available. And yes, it's an incredible time. To the point where I almost am forgetting about how I used to do my visual research. I mean, now it's just Google image search. It's great. I used to have, wall of books that I had to slowly and painstakingly collect of just pictures of everything. So if I needed to draw a thing, I had to figure out where, that picture might be, and that would take all day looking for it. And now it's just boop. And that's learning. I have sort of a anarchistic take on educational institutions. So in terms of what they ought to be doing, I really can't say. There's a whole world out there beyond them. Oh, and I also wanted to say that what seems to me to be the value of a degree is not evidence of learning, because there are many people that can demonstrate mastery over all kinds of things, but if they don't have that degree, they certainly won't be hired by a university. So to me, everything that the value of the university degree shows that you can deal with the university, that you can deal with that institution, which is a very special skill. And I guess that's what you master in a college. is dealing with a college.
And there are probably, you know, there will be lots of employers for a long time who find that a valuable skill to learn too, that you've managed to work within the system. David, you had another post on Joho, the blog, that is right in line with stuff we love to talk about here on This Week in Law on two fronts. This was your post titled, "Will a Google Car Sacrifice You for the Safe of Many?" and "Networked Road Neutrality." So we've definitely had several good conversations about the algorithms that will go into programming your self-driving car and deciding when it's going to swerve and who it's going to hit and not hit, which is what the first part of your post deals with. And then the second part is a wonderful turnaround, because through the whole net neutrality discussions of late, we've been frequently bringing up highways and traffic and fast lanes, you know, HOV lanes on the highway as, you know, examples of how an internet fast lane would work. Well, you're kind of flipping that around and saying, so once these cars are all driving themselves, we're going to have to make those same kinds of decisions for the road. You know, how are we going to decide who gets to drive in what what lane when the cars are all driving themselves? So this is just a fascinating post, and wondered if you could expand on it for us. Let us know more about networked road neutrality.
Well, sure. So the fundamental idea is behind the post is what happens when cars are networked and they're a swarm. Mm-hmm. And how does that change in the first half of the post? How does that change the sort of moral philosophy behind the programming? Because once they're all networked, the network can decide that the outcome with the few with the least harm in the case of some accident, about to happen, requires that the car that I'm in, the Google car that I'm in, needs to slam into a bridge abutment and kill me, because that will save the overall outcome will be less painful. And are we okay with cars deciding to kill some of their occupants for the sake of the greater good? And I would say, actually, yeah. I wouldn't be too happy about it, but that's the point of the greater good. And so the second half of it is, when they're networked, then you need some type of rules to determine who goes faster. And if we're going to apply network neutrality, which I strongly support, by the way, I'm very much so. But if we apply those to the rules of networked cars, we can certainly imagine that the Google cars are all following some protocol, but a Comcast car comes along and decides it wants to game the system. Its cars it gets more benefit if you can pay a Comcast car to go faster than to violate the protocol and go faster than what the Google swarm and the other cars have agreed upon. And if that's the case, then first of all, how would we feel about it? And second of all, this, by the way, exempts emergency vehicles, which we're going to probably let through faster anyway. But this is a rich guy who wants to get somewhere fast and so pays to have his car violate the rules. And if they do, then the post wonders whether, for example, Google cars could be programmed to swarm in order to block the lanes of the Comcast car, so it simply physically cannot violate the protocols that have been agreed upon. I have no idea, of course, what this should be, but we're going to have to figure out protocols, much like the internet protocols, to govern this. I'm sure people are working on this. I don't know about them. Maybe I should throw in, by the way, I don't know if you want to pursue this, Denise, but
sure.
The T-Mobile's offer to they will give you unlimited. They will remove songs downloaded, streamed through them, through some of the approved music streamers, will not count against your data cap, which sounds like a wonderful offer, but seems also to be a rank violation of net neutrality. And this is a case where I'm a little worried people will look at it and say, wait, no, that's I want that. Why wouldn't I want that? And the reason you wouldn't want that is because it establishes a precedent that, not a legal one, that, yeah, we're in favor of net neutrality when it's our bits who are going faster.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're going to see more and more of those data cap, not counting kinds of arrangements moving forward. I don't think T-Mobile was the first one. I'm struggling to remember what was. And I know we've talked about it on the show in the past, but I sense an opening of the dike along these lines, particularly when we hear in September what the open net rules are going to look like for good, or at least, you know, the current iteration becomes final. Nina, what do you think about, I think one that exactly what David was describing, you know, the cars all trying to broker their relationship with the road would make a great animated short.
Ooh, yeah. I think you could probably do a computer generated simulation of that. It's fascinating to think about. I love what David is saying. I was just like, I'm going, wow, that is so interesting. That is so insightful.
Yes.
But, you know, seeing that I've spent practically no time really thinking about this, I don't have much intelligent to say about it.
It doesn't stop me.
Now.
I will say that I still don't have a driver's license. Moving back here after New York, I planned to get one. And then I got a learner's permit, and then it expired because the winter was so horrible. There was ice and potholes and huge lines at the DMV. So all the Google car news, I'm just like, great. You know, there'll probably be a Google car before I get a driver's license.
Right. You're the perfect use case for the Google car. You need one.
Yeah. We'll track all my movements, and I'll be like, fine.
All right. Speaking of using things and one's ability to do so, let's move on to some copyright discussion. All right, Nina, you have done a great video that I'd love to be able to, with your permission, play in full. Yes.
Wait, what
video? I don't need your permission because I know that it is Creative Commons licensed for us to play it, which is wonderful. As we're getting it ready, Nina, why don't you tell us what was your idea in making this video? Why did you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and start taking pictures?
Oh, well, the idea is I think it was Lawrence Lessig that coined the term, all creative work builds on what came before, or it was probably before him, right? Because that came before too. And I figure there's evidence of this all throughout art history. So you walk through the Met or any other museum and, you know, usually things are grouped according to region, and you can walk through an exhibit and it'll move through time and you can see very clearly how styles and conventions and art evolved, and clearly people were looking at other things, and that's simply the nature of art. And you walk through a museum like that and imagine patents, copyright and trademark law. You know, none of this art could have happened. You would have, you know, a stick figure somewhere and then nothing else. So I was just trying to visually show the similarities between works. I did take some liberties, though, and for aesthetic reasons, it deviated from that occasionally.
So everything about this video is public domain or licensed for your use. Tell us about the music.
Oh, that music is by Todd Michelson, who did the music for Sita Sings the Blues. It's actually a piece of music that was available for Sita Sings the Blues, but I didn't have a place to put it, so it just ended up on this. But I would love to talk about my current thinking on licenses and free culture, because it's changed in the last year or two.
Good. Well, we don't have to play the video in its entirety. People who are watching our video are getting the idea that when you take photographs of art and mash them together, you can get a wonderful animation out of it that leapfrogs through periods of time and the centuries. And it's very, very cool, Nina. I'm really enjoying the video.
Yeah, like with those Indian statues or Asian statues, there are enough statues like that that are so similar to each other that you can actually make an animated cycle out of them, out of completely different statues, but it reads as a single movement.
Right.
It is so awesome.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Is. Yeah, it's kind of a long one. It's from a series called Minute Memes, where all the other ones were a minute, but this one is a whopping 3 minutes, which is very long. Oh, yeah, I was also thinking about the whole, like, you know, there are certain postures, you know, like the posture of Jesus that I have there. It's like, you know, somebody could like trademark this, right? You know, well, that's trademark. You know, you put someone in that position, that's mine. You know, the figure with the wings, yes. You know, a human being with wings, those weren't everywhere. They were usually in regions, you know, where people were seeing that somebody else had put wings on a person. It was like, that looks really cool. Or animals or things like that. Right. Oh, yes. So I was going to talk about licensing, unless you have any other questions about that.
No, tell us your current take on licensing and creativity.
Yes. So I have been a huge advocate of free licenses, but I realized that in spite of using these free licenses, I get permission requests all the time for things that are freely licensed, where I go out of my way to let everybody know that they already have permission for it. And the permission requests keep coming and the paperwork keeps coming. And I'm in these situations where it's like, well, you have to sign this paperwork before our lawyers will allow us to use this thing that you have gone out of your way to free. So the free licenses are not really solving the free culture problems that I care about, because to me, it's really important that people build upon other works.
So you're hearing from even though you have something that's a Creative Commons licensed that you've created that's out there for anybody to use for any purpose, you're still hearing from legal departments saying we still need her to sign something.
Yeah. And by the way, I have a little, you know, peeve about the Creative Commons licensed phrase, because, you know, there's all kinds of Creative Commons licenses. It's just a brand of a number of different licenses, some of which are free, some of which are not free. It goes back to the whole non-commercial thing, non-commercial license, you know, licenses with non-commercial restrictions aren't free. And they're all sort of lumped together in the popular imagination somehow. A lot of people assume that, even though I was using a share-alike license, they assumed that there were these non-commercial restrictions, which there never were. And Sita Sings the Blues, I released under the share-alike license, but then there's this problem of some people, you know, it's not clear what the freest kind of license is. Like, is it share-alike, where you can do anything with it except place copyright restrictions on it? Or is it just public domain, where, you know, you are free to remove the freedoms of a free license? You can restrict this thing that is free in derivative works. So Sita was initially share alike, and then I switched to just CC0 or public domain, because the National Film Board of Canada was insisting that I sign some fairly elaborate paperwork to allow a filmmaker to have an image of Sita somewhere in an audience in his movie, which, even if it were copyrighted, that wouldn't be necessary. That would have been fair use. It was like a 3D animated movie, and he had just had one, all these characters in an audience, and Sita was one of them. That would have been fine. That's fair use. But they wanted me to sign all this stuff, and I was like, look, this is share-alike. It's fine. And they're like, no, share-alike is viral, and you're going to make us, you know, share-alike our entire movie. And so I said, okay, fine, then. I'm just going to change the whole license to CC0, so I'll never have to sign any of these papers ever again. And they still wouldn't accept that. And they were basically telling the filmmaker that he had to go back to his film and take this picture of Sita's head out of his film, because I wasn't willing to sign this paperwork for the thing that I had put in the public domain. And that was right around the time that Aaron Schwartz died. And I was like, this is like insane. This world is insane. And it felt like a real moral affront to me that they were doing this and that I had to sign a stack of papers or they were going to censor this film. I mean, themselves willingly. It's not like the government was doing it. This was the film production's own. This was the National Film Board of Canada's own lawyers were going to make the filmmaker do this. So anyway, the issue isn't licenses. There's no license that's going to solve a problem. The issue is permission culture. So my focus now is what do you do about permission culture and the fact that people are so obsessed with, you know, basically stifling creativity until there's some kind of authority that allows them to express themselves. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with people's thinking about creativity, where the first thing you do is talk to a lawyer. You know, and that's in contrast to that short that you just showed, where this is showing like the history of human creativity and where it just flows very, very naturally. I feel like that is a human entitlement, and it's part of the human experience to be ingesting and expressing culture and being inspired and sharing and all that. So anyway, licenses don't solve the problem. For me, the greatest hope and greatest inspiration is in people that are increasingly ignoring the copyright status of anything. People are very confused by licenses and they're very, very confused by copyright itself. And that's fine with me because people are going ahead and putting things out there anyway. And that is actually what gives me the most hope. So, you know, I want to encourage that sort of behavior, which I realize is illegal in this world, but there is this concept called civil disobedience, which is a powerful force. So, intellectual disobedience. If it's intellectual property we're talking about, then intellectual disobedience is the solution.
Right. Well, that's very in keeping with what David was saying earlier about privacy and privacy law and norms and the fact that our law develops and evolves around the norms that are applicable and widely accepted at the time. And I think that you've hit on something very important, Nina, that as people become more and more confused and more willing to just ignore, as you say, that the law will shift, that, you know, it can go one of two ways. I mean, what we've seen in the last several decades is copyright terms becoming longer and longer rather than shrinking down to reflect things like patent terms of 20 years. Now we've got life plus 70 in the United States as the copyright term, which is very decimating to the public domain where you've been trying to put works. There's some great articles discussing this. Derek Khanna wrote one about all of the Disney works that are built on public domain works, but cannot be built on themselves because of the length of the copyright that Disney has advocated for. And something else to bear in mind is the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, which is still out there and people are still hammering away on and possibly finalizing before too long here. Let's see, we have some people proposing to extend the term under the TPP to what Mexico does, which is life plus 100. So definitely something to pay attention to there. But I think people are paying attention and that, you know, in Washington, there is a lot of discussion right now about copyright reform and whether our norms are properly reflecting what society actually deems proper and acceptable right now. So I think it's a really interesting topic and really appreciate your views on it, Nina. And of course, you're laboring despite armies of lawyers to contribute things to the public domain for people to use. David, as an author, do you have any thoughts on the status of copyright law and how our norms are possibly impacting it?
Well, you know, right now the norms are not impacting the law. I mean, as you say, it just gets worse and worse and worse, longer and longer. One of the things that really bothers me, again, as an old man, is that I've seen the assumption about copyright change, at least within the circle that I've been, haven't studied this, but from a belief that copyright is designed to enable arts and sciences to flourish, as it says in our Constitution, in which case you tend towards much, much shorter terms. Because as you say, 70 years after you're dead, we're not talking about enabling culture to flourish. We're talking about letting Disney flourish. And I don't actually care that much about Disney. I care much more about culture. So it has shifted from copyright as a mechanism for enabling a vibrant, robust flourishing of culture to copyright being a moral right that authors and creators increasingly, it seems to me, in my experience, feel that copyright is giving them something that they have a moral right to, that it's their work and they should be, it's wrong if somebody else benefits from their work. So copyright term runs out, the work gets republished, a publisher makes some money from it, the author doesn't make any money from it. That now seems morally wrong. It didn't seem that morally wrong 30 years ago, at least within the culture in which I moved. And I think it's very bad that it has shifted to a moral right, because it forgets the very first thing that Nina said in quoting Lessig, and Lessig, who is in a long line of people who have understood, going at least, Benjamin Franklin didn't patent anything because he understood that any idea that he had is just the latest little flourish on a long history of ideas that came before him. So it's really dangerous from my point of view that we've allowed copyright to become a matter of moral right instead of a primary way of enabling culture to flourish, which also means that we are losing the very first thing that Nina said, the sense that all of our great ideas, they're a little twist on what came before us, and they're not really our ideas. So it's a pretty depressing time, The people who are in a position to reform copyright, the people who are in power, the people who have the money to buy politicians, have apparently zero interest in reforming copyright. They instead want to enshrine it as a perpetual right that goes to an author on some specious moral ground.
Well, pile on the depressing note just stricken there, but... If people like unicorns, they better pay attention to this issue and make sure that copyright is not too confining. That is the message of a little cartoon that one of our listeners sent my way on Twitter. We could show that, I hope. It's in French. It says, Pourquoi les licornes ont disparu, which I believe means why the unicorns are disappearing. And here we have, for those who can't see it, a cute little unicorn with its horn and rainbow tail and mane. And then a narwhal swims up to it in the river next door and hands it a copyright infringement notice. And the final frame is the poor little unicorn in black and white, minus its horn, minus its rainbow mane and tail, and looking quite sad. So we do have to be mindful of what happens when copyright is too extreme. Yes.
Can I say something positive or encouraging?
Please.
Which is, I'm a boomer. I'm 63. Went to college 68 to 72. So pretty much prime hippie time. My entire generation smoked pot, and there was no still. Even so, there was no movement towards legalizing marijuana until the next generation came along. And in the same way, I hope this is not the case, but it's better than nothing. This may take another generation to get copyright, because we do have a generation whose norms have shifted, they download what they want. They watch what they want. And culture is enriched because of it. It may be that it will take that long, but it may happen.
Yep.
It may still happen.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think our second MCLE passphrase for the show will then be legalized sharing.
My current project that I'm doing is about the Exodus story. It's called Seder Masochism. And this whole 40 years in the desert metaphor is pretty apt when it comes to copyright. You have to have this whole generation of people die before you can get to the promised land.
All right. Well, I hope it happens sooner than that.
I don't think it will.
there certainly are competing interests in Washington, but this is the first time that I can really recall there being any kind of discussion and public opinion to the point, you know, where people are making cartoons about sad unicorns that is an influence on people in Washington in an opposite direction, in the non-rights holder, strong copyright direction. So, I don't know. I think I'm maybe a shade more optimistic that we don't need to spend 40 years waiting for it, but who knows? It's certainly been a while and we're not seeing much movement. So on that note, I think I'll give you all the opportunity to have a snack, because at least here in California, it's past lunchtime. And you're probably getting the munchies about now, especially with David reminding us all that in certain places in the country, marijuana has become legal for recreational, not just medicinal purposes. So, you know, what you might want to grab and have handy is something good to eat, and that's Nature Box. You know, it's easy to talk about eating right, but when you're starving, either at lunchtime or at 3 p.m. or at 3 a.m., whenever the munchies strike you, all cranky and lightheaded, you don't want the evil vending machine to be your only friend. You want to keep your eye on looking and feeling great. And that's why you want to go to naturebox.com/twit. Now, I'll tell you, my only complaint about this product is we can't keep enough of it on hand. One box a month isn't enough. I need an option where we can get two or three coming, because we rip through it all so quickly. But you're going to want to start out with one of their subscription options. The longer you subscribe, the better pricing you get. Well, then once you place your order, you can select which snacks you'd like in your monthly box. You can select by your dietary needs. There are vegan options, soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, and non-GMO. You can also select by taste, savory, sweet, or spicy. And then NatureBox is going to send you great-tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the U.S., That's healthy, satisfying snacks. Poppy seed sticks, peppery pistachios, over 100 more, all with zero trans fat, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. Nature Box is the snack happy gift that keeps on giving. That's available in a 3, 6, or 12-month subscription for that special someone, friend, or family member. And don't forget, you know, it's June. If you're not wearing a bathing suit, you know what? I am. Right now, after this show, I'm headed down to the beach. So I'm paying attention to what kinds of snacks I'm putting in my also aging body. And they're not coming from a vending machine. They're coming from Nature Box. You're going to find really, really delicious food there. Big Island pineapple being one of the choices. So don't take my word for it. And don't pay full price. There's no reason to do that. You can get 50% off your first box by going to naturebox.com/twit. It's going to keep you full and strong and healthy. Thank you so much, NatureBox, for your support of This Week in Law. Hashtag ad. In case that you needed any enlightenment on that front. I think we will move on to our tip of the week, which is we were talking about people who were all in or all out on the privacy front, you know, how much information they put about themselves online. Part of our, it seems like our tips of the week are sort of a version of the Dumb Ways to Die app, you know, examples of people who've done something just a little bit too far. I'd say this is maybe too all in, even despite worse than Robert Scoble, exhibiting no judgment whatsoever, not just in his course of actions, but then sharing them all online. This would be a 19-year-old in Florida, of course, His name is Dupree Johnson. And what Mr. Johnson did was get himself slapped with 142 felony counts. He decided to put his massive collection of stolen firearms on Instagram. And lots and lots of pictures of him engaged in illegal activities with his buddies and holding stacks of cash. He's nothing if not honest, though. Apparently, the police asked him his occupation, and he replied, thief. So the guy was very all in, very transparent. Unfortunately, this was not a good choice on his part. So our tip of the week is all in works when you are behaving in societally acceptable legal ways. And then our resources of the week are twofold. Number one, we're talking about things like fair use. I think you could have a lengthy fair use discussion about a video I'd like to play for you now, a mashup of the Book of Mormon and South Park. Again, one of our listeners pointed me toward this on Twitter. Thank you so much for the pointer. Let's cue it up and play a bit here.
Hello, my name is Elder Price, and I would like to share with you the most amazing book.
Hello, my name is Elder Grant. It's a book about America a long, long time ago.
It has so many awesome parts, you simply won't believe how much this book can change your life.
Hello, my name is Elder Green. I would like to share with you this book of Jesus Christ. Hello.
So I think what happened here is the animator decided that South Park and the Hello song from the Book of Mormon would go well together. And using clips from South Park created this animation. I'm not sure if the Mormons were in an actual South Park episode or if he did that animation separately. Obviously, some of the animation is right out of the show. He's used the entirety of the Book of Mormon song, but it's certainly transformative. I think you could have a really vibrant fair use discussion about that. So I wanted to give it to you guys as our resource of the week, just to ponder the nature of fair use. And the song is still up. It's someone in IRC is asking if it's possible takedown. It certainly is, I'd say, based on the music. But so far, the video is up. And we'll just have to watch that one and see if they have to go through the notice and takedown process or not. Nina, do you have any fair use thoughts on the Book of Mormon mashed up with South Park?
Yeah, well, Parker and Stone are not idiots, and if they are aware of this, I'm sure they would do everything that they can to make sure it is not taken down. I could imagine an auto takedown, you know, a robot right. doing it, but they would not do something that dumb.
No, but the Book of Mormon rights holders might. Just based on the music, it might trigger content ID.
Who are the Book of Mormon rights holders? They wrote the Book of Mormon. I mean,
No. I mean, the music and the folks who are responsible for the musical.
No, but they are. They are responsible for the musical. Parker and Stone, the same people that did South Park, are responsible for the Book of Mormon musical. It's their musical.
I did not know this. This is news to me. I'm learning something from our resource of the week. All the more reason I have to get out and see that show. So, and all the more reason the mashup
they collaborated
is
with people that worked on Avenue Q and probably many other people. But yeah, they're responsible for it.
All right. So that may explain why it's not getting taking down. That's wonderful. Well, yes. And again, it's a great commentary then by mashing the two together. So I great little fair use brain teaser there. And then we thought that today we might be discussing the Supreme Court's decision in Aereo. That's not the case. The court did not issue that decision this week. It has a short amount of time in which to do so before the end of its term. We might see it next Monday, we might see it next Thursday, or we might see it the following Monday, June 30th. So, of course, we're keeping an eye on that. And in the meantime, and the beginning of this article that we're pointing to as our resource about Aereo by Matt Schreurs, he kicks things off by saying, as the IP nerd vigil over Aereo continues, and he's done a great service to those holding that vigil by going through every possible kind of outcome that the court could give us. What happens if the lower court's decision is affirmed? What happens if it's reversed, either narrowly or broadly? What happens if the decision below is vacated or remanded? What happens if we can't get consensus from the justices? And some other even less likely outcomes. He's gone through them all. So if you're wanting your primer on what may happen in Aereo in the next week and a half or so, this is what you want to read. It's been so fun to go through these big issues with you guys today. David, just such a pleasure to reconnect with you. Tell us more what you're doing at Harvard these days. And you must have a book in the works.
It's wonderful to talk with you as well. I sort of have a beginning of a book in the works as something to do with how we think about the future in an age of platforms. Until September, I co-direct the Library Innovation Lab, which is a little software lab that does with fantastic developers who do amazing things trying to think about the future of libraries and software. And
very cool. We're so glad that you could take the time to join us today. Folks, definitely check out Joe Hove the blog and David's books that are already published and available for you to read, because they'll really help you think about information and the world we live in today. And Nina, it's just a great pleasure to have you back on the show. You're so talented and so funny and such a great advocate for free culture and copyright reform. And we're thrilled to have had the chance to spend some time with you today as well.
Thanks so much. It was fun. And David's very cool. I really liked hearing what you had to say.
Well, that you are awesome. How about that?
No, you're awesome. Yeah,
no, you are. But you are. So that's
yes. The word awesome is apparently passe. And, here I am at the University of Illinois, where apparently we have like a fantastic library school. So I don't know if you ever
come through
Champaign-Urbana. Let me know.
You have an awesome, your library school is fantastic. Seriously. Awesome. Absolutely awesome.
Well, come on by.
Since the Lego movie just came out on demand and everything else, I've got Everything is Awesome on constant repeat in my brain lately. So everything is awesome, and you guys are too. And it's been so fun doing the show with you today. We do the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So that's when you should tune in if you're going to watch live. If you can't watch live, don't worry about it, because you can watch the show on your own time by going to twit.tv/twill is where our archive of shows lives, or you can head on over to the YouTube channel. That's at This Week in Law on YouTube. YouTube.com/This Week in Law is where you're going to find that. Our discussion points are at delicious.com/This Week in Law, and then the particular show number if you want to see more about what we have considered today or on any of the other shows. And one thing I should mention is right after the show wraps each week, I always go and find a Creative Commons licensed image on Flickr. And I don't ask anybody's permission, and I don't make them sign extra paperwork. I just go ahead and use the image based on the Creative Commons license that they have.
I think you need to cover your butt a little more.
That's right. No, it's funny, you know, I mean, people do change their licenses from time to time. So you do want to pay attention to what license you're using and what it gives you the rights to do. But I'm always careful to use the one that has that is available for commercial use. And we use those images. Sometimes we use them on the show page while we're waiting to put up the video, or it might be the image that you see exactly when you're about to watch the video. We use them on our Facebook page. We use them on our Google Plus page to change up the covers there each week. And I always tweet them out too. So that's our way of supporting the whole Creative Commons universe of works, which has literally tens of millions of photographs on Flickr that are now under Creative Commons licensing. And we can always find something fun that fits one of the themes of the show. So just wanted to mention that. We hardly ever talk about the fact that we do that and that we rely heavily on the Creative Commons universe to help produce the show each week, and that the shows themselves too, we should mention all the Twitch shows are under a Creative Commons license. And I'm wondering how much the business office, the studio in Petaluma gets mail like you've described, Nina, of people wanting to use the show under the license, but wanting to just belt and suspenders the whole process. I'm sure that happens from time to time as well. Let's see, what else should I tell you? If you want to get in touch by email, I'm Denise at twit.tv. And my co-host, who will be back next week, is Evan at twit.tv. You can and should find us on Twitter too. We put a bunch of stuff in the show today that came to us from people on Twitter. I'm Dee Howell there. Evan is Internet Cases there. We also pay attention to our Facebook page and Google Plus page and community. So if you need a little bit more space and don't feel like emailing us, that would be the way to go. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Thanks so much for joining us today.